on the inside. She got the scoop on the ones to watch, on the ones that's hot. No one can do it quite like Caroline. No one can do it quite like Caroline. It's time for Caroline.
I am so excited about this episode. I have Michael Chandler on today. He is a two-time MMA world champion. Not only is he an incredible fighter, I've watched him fight and it is insane. I've watched him on pay-per-view. I've watched him on the internet. This guy is crazy good. He is such a competitor. He is so great, obviously, world champion. And he's so positive. We talk all about how he stays motivated, the importance of self-talk, positive self-talk, and just the power of believing in yourself. He is such an inspirational person. I told him he needs to be an inspirational speaker in his next life because this guy is the most positive, inspiring person you will ever meet. Y'all get excited. Michael Chandler.
Okay, I'm so stoked. Michael Chandler is in the house and oh my gosh, I feel a little bit overwhelmed because you're a world champion. You are a two-time world champion of the lightweight division for MMA fighting. Mm-hmm. And tell me, how did you get into this sport to begin with? And it's so layered because people are confused. Like someone like me, is it boxing? Is it UFC? Is it MMA? Is it what's Bellator? There's so many layers. There's so many. How did you get involved with the sport? And now you are sitting at the top of your game.
So for me, it started out with just wrestling. I wrestled in high school, wrestled in college, was in love with the sport of wrestling.
You were from the very beginning.
Absolutely, yes.
What did you love about it?
Well, I think for me, I wasn't a big guy. I wasn't going to excel at football because I wasn't big and tall and whatever. I wasn't going to excel at basketball. Wrestling was the perfect kind of blue collar, work hard and good things are going to happen. And it really is the toughest sport in the entire world.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you talk to anybody who has wrestled or knows wrestlers, they will agree that it's that grind and it's so hard and it's tough and it's weight cutting. And when you're not weight cutting, you're training extremely hard. And then you couple them both together and it's constant ups and downs and emotional roller coaster. And it's made me the man that I am and the husband I am and the father I will be.
What did it teach you?
I mean, I think it's just the constant stick-to-itiveness and the constant just honestly getting beat down and then build back up and beat down and build back up. And it's just that constant faith and that constant groundedness of knowing that if I show up every single day and I lace my, you know, I put my mouthpiece in, I lace my shoes up and I go as hard as I can, I get outside of my comfort zone, good things are going to happen. And even when bad things do happen, it's only a matter of time before I'm back on top again or I win again.
You've seen that proven over and over again through this career that you've chosen.
Yeah. So I think there's no way that I would be sitting here as a multiple time world champion without the sport of wrestling, you know? So it was great. And I wrestled in high school and then college, wrestled at Mizzou. So
wrestling is obviously different than MMA. Mm-hmm. Wrestling is not quite as intense as MMA, right?
Well, to me, it's actually a harder sport.
Okay.
I think if you watch a wrestling match and you watch an MMA fight, you're gonna see, you know, punches, kicks, knees, elbows, cuts, bruising, stitches in an MMA fight, knockouts, submissions. But the sport of wrestling, the amount of dedication that it takes to make it to that top 1% is so much more than the sport of mixed martial arts. But when you talk about intensity, when you talk about entertainment and blood and guts and crazy craziness and literally the volatility inside of a competition, mixed martial arts is one of the most exciting sports in the entire world.
So. Do you think it's one of the more dangerous sports? Are you ever worried about your health?
A little bit. I think it's ignorance is bliss type of situation.
You can't worry about it.
Yeah, you know, and I just think I wouldn't have been called to this sport. God would not have called me to this sport if great things were going to happen or harm was going to be done. And I've had numerous sets of stitches. I've had eyes swollen shut and lips turned inside out and injuries and losses and tears. And I've been on top of the world and I've been down in the dumps. And it's been such a crazy, crazy sport. But it's, you know, I truly believe that I was put on this earth to be a world champion and reach people on my platform. So I try not to think about it, you know.
But, you know, this is your calling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I'm very big on callings too. Mm-hmm. I think we all have a calling. And I think it's so important to take the time to figure out what it is. But you found yours fairly quickly right away in high school with wrestling.
Yeah, with wrestling.
And that, so you just, you fell in love with wrestling, mm-hmm. and then you became the best at wrestling.
Yes. Well, not as good as I wanted to be. You know, I think I fell short in wrestling, and that's what really propelled me to having a very successful MMA career. And I was extremely, extremely blessed. I was the oldest of three boys, you know, so I never had a big brother. But when I came into college, I immediately started taking my lumps and getting beat up by the upperclassmen. And you know, there's two guys right now who are world champions in other organizations. So I fight for Bellator. There's the welterweight champion of the UFC, Tyron Woodley, and there's the welterweight champion of 1FC, Ben Askren, who I wrestled with both of them in college.
Wow, so y'all kind of rose to
you. Oh, yeah.
And so you were telling me earlier, Bellator, it's like UFC, Bellator. Break down what those are for people who might be confused on how it's all divided up.
Yeah, so the sport is mixed martial arts. The sport is MMA. We fight under the unified rules of mixed martial arts.
Okay,
and
all
then,
y'all.
Yeah, so underneath the sport of mixed martial arts, there are different organizations. And the organizations, the first one was the UFC. They came around and basically started the sport in 1992, 1993, I believe. And then Bellator came around in 2008. There was Strikeforce, there's 1FC, there's World Series of Fighting. We are all the different organizations. And then under those organizations are contracted fighters. So
okay.
I'm a 1099 employee to Bellator.
Okay, you know? So you fight only Bellator fighters.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I'm contracted in Bellator. And there's the guys in the UFC, and there's the guys in Bellator and 1FC. We don't cross-promote, you know, and whenever my contract is up, I either choose to re-sign a deal with Bellator and continue my services with them, or I shop around, I become a free agent, just like football, just like baseball, just like basketball.
Oh, okay.
So, there's a lot.
It's such a powerful platform that you're on, because you are literally using your body mm-hmm. as your instrument to have your platform, to have your calling. And so the training, mental, physical, how do you mentally train? Because I feel like so much of it has to be mental.
Oh, my gosh.
So when you're transferring from wrestling and getting into MMA, are you deciding in your mind, then I'm going to be the best? Like, what goes on in the process of you evolving into this world champion?
Well, I think that the funny thing about the evolution of my career is I think there's been ups and there's been downs, and there's been times where I have 100% believed in myself, and then there's been times where either I got complacent with my self-belief, or I wasn't seeking that self-belief and that motivation and that positive self-talk that I should have been.
So you,
and
you,
I find myself...
Positive self-talk's crucial for
you.
Oh,
my gosh. It literally is everything. In my career, I came into the sport sky high thinking, okay, Michael, we're an All-American. I was an All-American in wrestling, which is a very small percentage of people who can become All-Americans at the Division One wrestler at the Division One wrestling ranks in college. And so when I came into the sport, I told myself, okay, Michael, you've worked harder than all these guys. You might not be as skilled, you might not be as good on paper, you might not be ranked as high, but you can go out there and beat them. And literally a year and a half after I stepped into the cage, I became world champion and ranked top five in the world. So within 22 months or something, I was world champion right out of college. So I found success really quickly.
Do you think it's because you wanted it maybe more too? Because obviously you're at this point, you all have talent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So what separates the world champions from the people who are all talented?
I think it's toughness. I think it's consistency, consistent belief, and confident expectancy of really truly believing what you deserve, you know. And I think in college I would tell the reporters, or I would tell my coach, or I would tell teammates, I want to be a national champion. I want to be a national champion. And if you watch the way I trained, I would train harder than everybody every single day.
Really?
Yes, but mentally I didn't truly believe that I was going to be a national champion. I didn't truly believe
that. You're telling yourself though.
Yeah, well, I wasn't as much back then. I would tell other people. But when it was just me alone in my thoughts, it was the fear of being successful. Or I can remember numerous times where I was winning a match and all of a sudden I would find a way to lose. You know, so
if you would find a way to lose.
I would sabotage myself.
You would sabotage yourself. You think you did it on purpose?
Not on purpose, but I think it's that cognitive dissonance. And it's this is the what I've
well, kind of, that mean, what does that mean? That's a good word.
So let me
you're so smart.
Let me become a psychologist really quickly. No, but cognitive dissonance is basically what it, I think what is happening not truly lining up with your beliefs. So I was about to beat, say, a guy named CP Schlater, who was ranked top three in the country at the time, and I was just a freshman or sophomore. I wasn't supposed to beat him, but I was up by like 5 or 6 points. So what was happening in real life didn't line up with my self-belief. My self-belief was, you'll never be able to beat CP Schlater. You're not as good as him.
You are, maybe you hadn't gotten there yet. You didn't feel like you were ready yet or something.
Or you just fear of being great because you're not sure what is on the other side of greatness, what that entails, or, you know, so it's what is happening not lining up with what you truly believe, you know? So I didn't truly believe that I could beat him, so I would find a way, and I ended up finding a way to lose. I got taken down, and then he let me go, and I got taken down again, and it's a point system, and I lost. And after the match, it was kind of like, what the heck just happened? How did you lose that match? That you had that match. So
how do you process it? How do you realize that you were self-sabotaging a little bit?
I think I didn't really realize that till after college, and I started fighting, and then
what
I kind of
changed.
I think really taking ownership of self-belief, taking ownership of self-talk, taking ownership of realizing that, I mean, a couple generations ago, our parents, our grandparents, they didn't have YouTube. They didn't have podcasts. They didn't have, do you realize, I mean, yourself or our listeners at home, how easy it is to pick up your phone and listen to so much positive stuff? So, like, Zig Ziglar, it was from like the 1980s, 1970s, and all of his stuff is still, has turned into podcasts and into all of these things. And you can listen to your favorite sermon, your favorite pastor, your favorite motivational speaker, YouTube videos. I mean, it's so easy to stay built up in the year 2017 in our generation,
absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
So I think it was taking ownership of realizing that, okay, I work harder than anybody else at the gym, but what's going to happen the other 20 hours of the day? You know, what are you going to do?
It's up here.
What are you going to read? What are you going to say? What are you going to believe? What are you going to watch? What are you going to decide to really dwell on? You know?
So you have made it your prime because you, okay. Oh, you're like, my head's exploding right now. So you are someone who actually has to walk the walk and talk the talk, because if you don't have your mental game in check, you can have your physical body at the top of your game, but if your mental game's not there, mm-hmm. That is just as important.
So much more important.
And a lot of people don't have to work on their mental game as much as someone like you does, because we can skate through life and we don't have to really, like, you know, our careers don't depend on the state of our mental being, but you have to be tuned up all the time in your mind.
Absolutely. And because it's all, and really, and I always say this, I'm not actually going out there and getting locked into a cage fighting against another man. I'm really fighting against myself. You know, am I going to let myself go out there and perform the way that I know I can perform?
Let yourself.
You know, and that's what I always say, and I ask myself this all the time. Michael, somebody, at the end of the day, somebody has to be the best. Why shouldn't it be you?
Why shouldn't it? So you have to tell yourself that you do deserve that.
Always, and because everything I do in the gym, live my life right, you know, what I put into my body, how often I sleep, like every single thing adds up to becoming the best fighter of all time. But on the mental aspect of it, that's the only way that doesn't happen, you know? But that's so important in visualization and really realizing that visualizing things. The brain, I've done a lot of reading or a lot of research realizing that the brain doesn't really truly know the difference between, you know, me picking up a pen or me closing my eyes and watching myself pick up that pen and pick up that pen. Your brain doesn't quite know the difference between something actually happening and something visual, like you actually visualizing something happen. And I'm not gonna say I can sit here and you know, say visualize something and it's gonna happen like this kind of.
People
claim
that can happen if you really do have that focus.
And it really is. And now, as I get older in my career, I've closed my eyes and I've visualized stepping into the cage and the smell of the cage and the sounds of the crowd and the lights and then seeing my opponent in front of me and all these things. And then all of a sudden I step into the cage and I feel like I'm at home. I feel like I've been there. And I used to not do that. I used to step into the cage and just bite down on my mouthpiece and go run and it was a crazy fight. And now things have slowed down so much more because I've visualized.
So you go through the fight ahead of time. What is your warm-up? Mm-hmm. So say, okay, you just had, let's get to your big fight that you just had, because this was huge. You've already won 2-time world champion lightweight of the world for the Bellator division.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, this summer, you're gearing up again. You're going back for three, and mm-hmm. you're playing at Madison. You're not playing. You're fighting at Madison Square Garden.
That was my last fight.
That was this last one.
Yeah, that was my last one at Madison Square Garden.
Yes.
So yeah.
So tell me about that, and tell me about your process getting ready for it, and then getting in the fight, and then how dealing with things when they don't go as you have visualized.
Yeah. So. It was the biggest fight of my. I mean, it's the biggest platform. And I think when
Madison Square Garden pay-per-view. I mean, people are betting probably millions of dollars on this fight.
Yeah. So when you
is that pressure or do you not worry about that?
No, I try not to. I mean, in the unfortunate thing about fighting at Madison Square Garden is you don't really truly get to experience it or enjoy it because you don't want to think about Madison Square Garden. You don't want to think about warming up in the same locker room as Mike Tyson or walking the same halls as George Foreman or Muhammad Ali. You don't want to think about those things because with that comes added pressure. Added pressure comes a higher heart rate. Yeah, a higher heart rate and a less mental stability, you know. So you just kind of focus on the task at hand. But it was awesome and it was crazy and it was the biggest platform of my career and it is just it's another testament to how crazy this sport is that I was better than my opponent on paper. I was better than my opponent in stats, it was better than my opponent and everything. And then all of a sudden, 30 seconds into the fight, I rolled my ankle, jammed up and pinched a nerve in my ankle. My whole ankle went limp, like basically for
but
the
it
next.
It didn't like break because I was wondering if your foot was gonna
okay. It looked so bad. It was.
Oh my God.
It was basically just I had no control over it. You know, so my brain was telling myself to take a step forward, and it wasn't working. And,
oh my God! And, what are you thinking in this moment? Because I know we're all panicking.
Yeah, you know, I think it was just. It was just stay calm, you know, and I kept telling myself, you're fine, you're going to get the distance, you're going to knock him out on one foot. And
you were just going to do it with one foot?
Yeah, I was. And I ended up, the only real punch that landed in the entire fight was me on one leg, and I knocked him down, and then I overzealously went and chased him, and my ankle rolled like three other times, and then the ref, like, stopped the fight, you know. So it was, and then the doctors came in, and they were feeling around on my ankle, and one doctor was looking at the other doctor and said, I think his ankle's broken, I think it's a tibia fracture, and this, that, and the other thing. I'm just pleading with the doctors, please don't stop the fight, I promise, it's just an ankle cramp, it's something, just let me go back out there, I promise you I'm going to win this fight. And I kind of looked over at my opponent and gave him the old, you better hope that these guys stop the fight right now, you know, just kind of playing those mind games and that mental game. And, you know, but with that comes this huge letdown. You know, I spent 9 weeks away from my wife. I trained down in Florida. We saw each other 4 days in 9 weeks, which you know how that is.
Yeah.
We're having a traveling musician as a husband, but it's
intense and you're not ever letting
up.
Like, it's not like with traveling musicians, you know, mm-hmm. at least like it's not the wake up, go to bed, all you eat, sleep, and breathe is this. Because when you're preparing for a fight like that, you're probably so focused.
Yeah, and it consumes you. And my wife is a saint for dealing with
wife.
It. Yeah, but the dieting and the sleep schedule and the training.
The diet is
and then,
so, you have to weigh a certain thing. You have to mm-hmm. eat.
But I have to lose about 30 pounds. I'm like 185 right now. I got to get down to 155, so.
How do you lose weight like that?
Diet, exercise, and then the last 10 pounds or so is just water weight. But it's.
So do you have a training? How long is training period?
Training camp is 8 weeks usually, 8-9 weeks. And it's so it's about 2 months. And I usually do a 12-week block training camp. But the first 4 weeks, the first 4 weeks is kind of pre-camp. And I'm not crazy with my diet and I'm not crazy with my sleep schedule. I'm not crazy with all that kind of stuff. But that 8 weeks out is go time.
So is there a fight season?
There's not a fight season. So we fight 12 months a year. It just depends on each promotion. They do their schedule for each 6 months probably, and they say, well, hey, like right now I'm expecting to fight in December, but it's not set in stone yet. I'm trying to get the guy who has my belt to fight me in December.
So you have to get the guy who's holding the belt. Basically, what if they're too scared to fight you because they don't want to give their belt up? Do they have the ability to say no?
They don't have the ability to say no per se. I mean, they do, but it's in their best interest to fight. I mean, we fought in June. And
so this is the Madison Square Garden fight.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying rematch. If he doesn't give you a rematch.
Yeah, well, I mean, he has to.
If he doesn't,
he's going to get, basically the promotion is just going to either, number one, strip him of the belt, or number two, just say, okay, well, we don't like you anymore. Therefore, we're going to go ahead and go a different direction, and you can just go ahead and sit there in Oregon and do whatever you want to do.
So he has to give you a rematch. Because we're all, the world is wanting a rematch. Because it wasn't, you didn't get your fair shot.
No, yeah. So it's interesting. He'll give me that. He'll give me the rematch. I'm hoping it's in December, but it was such an unfortunate, weird set of circumstances. But once again, it's another opportunity to let the world see how you react to something, And it's even though it was a bad thing that happened, when I get the belt back and whenever people see the comeback and then whenever they see how the setback set me up for the comeback and the way that I reacted to that loss and that the biggest stage of my life and the biggest opportunity of my life that was pretty much taken away from me because of a quick little injury that was completely out of my control. People see that and they remember how you made them feel and they remember the things that you said and they remember how you carry themselves. And then if it just takes one or two young kids to say, I want to be like that someday, or that's what we get to do as fighters or as athletes or as anybody who's in the public eye. So it's good and I'm excited to get the belt back.
Do you love being a comeback kid?
I do, but unfortunately, to being a comeback kid means you had to come back from something.
I know.
But it's
so exhausting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I burst onto the scene, like I said, and I won the world title within a year and a half, two years, defended the belt numerous times, and I lost three fights in a row. So I was 12-0 to start my career, then I lost three fights in a row. I went 688 days.
Does that get in your head?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So 688 days without winning a fight, and that's where I really grew the most and realized that the stuff that I was telling you about, the visualization and all that kind of stuff, how important it is because, you find yourself making jokes about it. And me and my wife would be hanging out and be like, well, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose three in a row. And you make dumb little jokes and you laugh about them because you're a positive person and you can make light of a bad situation. But what you don't realize is that you really are teaching yourself bad habits and bad self-talk, and you're continuing to lower your standards or lower your view of yourself by even entertaining those kind of jokes and
stuff
like
that. So what did you change? So how do you change that self-talk? What are the first steps you do?
Well, I think, number one, realizing that every single person that you look up to, every single person that I look up to, every single person that anybody has looked up to has been a failure at one point or another. Mm-hmm. But realizing that failure is an event, not a person, is so huge, and realizing that, that you could Google celebrities or successful people that failed, and there's 100,000 examples, right? But for some reason, whenever you fail, you think, oh my gosh, I'm the biggest failure ever.
You think everyone's just sitting there laughing at you or
exactly,
talking about it.
Exactly. When really, if you realize that failure is a prerequisite to success, and
that would be like when Oprah says, "Tweetable moment,"
right?
It really is
because I think, and that's exactly what I did. Was Michael, you got to be perfect. Michael, you're world champion. Michael, people are looking at you, and you're top three in the world, and you're expected to perform like this, 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 and this. And it wasn't just my fights; it became my workouts. And if I got taken down, or I got submitted, or I lost a sparring session, or I lost this, or I lost that, or I couldn't lift this weight like I thought I could.
Like, well, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm world champion.
Yeah, and it's a loss, and now it's another loss, and it's another loss, and it's another loss. When really it's not a loss. These things are just the chain of events that happen in a fight camp or in a career. And so many, every single person that we've looked up to, you look at them and you think, man, I wish I could be like that, or I wish I could be like that. But what you don't realize is that layer of failures and shortcomings and setbacks that they've had. And I think realizing, it comes with maturity, and it comes with being around the block but if I was sitting here and talking to an 18-year-old guy who's so excited to fight and become the best fighter in the world, he's going to think I'm a little bit crazy, talking about failing and then becoming successful, because we think we just have to be successful all the time. But you're going to fail, but it's an event and it's not a person, and that's really what it is. And I am living proof of that. And so I have been the comeback kid numerous times, but I think it's just, like I said, taking extreme ownership, realizing that my brain and my mind and myself, my self-esteem and my self-image, you could sit there and give me all the compliments in the world, but if I don't receive them, and if I don't truly believe them, if I don't truly give them to myself and continue to grow on my own, in my own head, in my own body, in my own spirit, that growth doesn't actually happen, Mm-hmm. So it's really taking ownership of your own mental warfare, honestly, So.
So tell me, what is your motivation? Why do you do it? Why do you press on?
I think motivation continues to change, I think now it's realizing that I am not just a fighter, but I'm a husband, and I'm going to be a future father, and we don't have children yet, but I know I already see their faces.
You do. So you're visualizing that, too.
I'm excited. And it's them, but it's also me being a great father or trying to become a great father or doing the things that I want to do that adds up to being a great father and a great leader and a great servant to them and my wife. But so that is part of it now. But I think in the very beginning, and it has stayed the same, what has stayed the same is realizing that I've been given such a great opportunity to be sitting here on two capable legs and have two capable arms to literally be able to go out and do something that 0.00001% of the world gets to do, you know, and to be able to, even on the days that it's horrible, even on the days that it's painful, even on the days that I want to cry, even on the days that I'm icing this or I'm taking ibuprofen for that, or, you know, and you get beat down, even on those bad days, there's so many people that would love to be in my position, and I have such a great opportunity that I've been given and such a platform that I have to be able to inspire so many people. And so I think it's that. And it's not that I feel that there's an obligation or I have to do this because of other people. There's still that inner drive and that inner knowing that God put me in this sport for a reason. But it is realizing that so many people have done so much more with what they have. So I've been given these gifts, and I'll be darned if I'm going to squander them, you know? So I have been given so many amazing gifts, and hopefully I can continue to fight for a really long time, but probably just another couple of years, and then we'll sail off into the sunset and figure out what the next venture is.
I love, though, that you take your talents so seriously, because I feel that if we all could dig into our soul and really latch on to our talent, mm-hmm. and treat it like the gift that it is, like how you have done with yours, I feel like the world would be such a happier place, because people would be fulfilling the reason why they're on this earth.
Mm-hmm. I don't know where I read it. I'm not going to say it's my quote, but I think, I read something that kind of disregarding or not fully living out that purpose in your life is a slow suicide.
You know,
you get so far along and you realize, why didn't I take this chance, or why didn't I, you know, stop this or stop that, or decide to do this or decide to do that, you know? And honestly, for me, it's easy. And that's when you know you're doing what you're called to do, when it's easy.
I was gonna say, how do you know when you're on the right path?
I don't wake up every morning and like, gosh, I gotta go to workout again, or gosh, I gotta go to this thing again, or gosh, I gotta go, you know, eat right again. Here's my eggs and avocado and spinach, and I just did it for the last, you know, 6 months, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's.
You're not mad about it.
No, not at all, because I realize it's the means to the end. It's a means to an end, which in the end is the end goal is winning a fight. And each time you win a fight, it's a bigger platform, and each bigger platform is more and more people and more eyeballs and more and more people that can hear your name or hear the words that you speak, you know? So it's easy, you know? That's when you know you're doing what you're called to do, is when it becomes the routine is easy for you. And it's not, there's nothing holding you back, and you just continue to move forward in something, and the goals get bigger and the goals get scarier, but you're not afraid because you know you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Okay, I want to ask you a few like little kind of rapid fire questions.
Okay.
They're kind of going to go a little deep.
Oh, shoot.
Because I know you have Blessed tattooed on your chest.
Yeah.
Which I think is awesome that you tattooed that on your chest. Mm-hmm. So when you're in the ring, the first thing people are seeing, obviously you're going to go straight to your tattoo, mm-hmm. is Blessed. And why is that so important for you to have that as your statement piece?
I think it goes back to realizing how truly blessed I am, you know? And it's not a proclamation that, hey, look at me, look how blessed I am. It's me when I look in the mirror and I realize that I am so blessed, and I did have parents that poured into me, and I had a phenomenal childhood, and they did everything they possibly could to put me to where I am. And then I worked extremely hard, and I had extremely great people in my path, and God has put so many perfect people in my path for the perfect season that I was in to get me to that next level, to get me to that next breakthrough, and then meeting my wife, and then now we have the next 50, 60, 70 years to continue to move forward and meet more people. And it's just been, I've been so truly blessed that it's a constant reminder for me that to give anything less than my best every single day really is to sacrifice those blessings. And I do it sometimes, and then, but it's a kick in the butt to realize, hey, why are you being lazy? Or hey, why are you not doing what you said you were going to do? Why are you not giving 110%? Because there's going to be days that are like that, you know? But you realize, you know, you just kind of acknowledge the time that was lost, or you acknowledge the day that you were lazy, or you acknowledge the bad decision that you made, and you realize that the sun really will come up tomorrow morning, and yesterday really did end last night, and you continue to move forward. So that's kind of my, that's kind of where the blessed tattoo came from, I believe.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a few rapid question, fire questions.
Okay.
What is faith? You can just, you don't have to give a long answer. You can give one word. You can give whatever you feel called to give. But what is faith? What does faith mean?
Faith is I think, blindly moving forward with something that you truly, truly believe, and the conviction that you know the truth, you know, I guess just the truth, you know, like you know what it is, even though you're not 100% sure of everything, but you know what it is. If that makes sense.
Yes, totally. What is the point of this life?
The point of this life, I think, is for me, it's helping and inspiring as many people as possible, whether it be through direct contact or whether it be someone that you've never even met, and truly, fully living up to your potential. Because if you do truly live up to that potential, more and more people are going to be impacted.
What is the one thing that causes people to get in their own way?
I think it's the lack of self-belief, you know? And it's, and it's, and it is so hard. Sorry, I might go a little bit longer than, rapid. I might be a little less rapid. But I think it's that lack of self-belief, and a lot of times it's because we are afraid of being cocky, or afraid of being overconfident, or afraid of being looked at like better than people. And I think I did that. And my,
you didn't want to act like you were aloof or above.
No, and it's, and it's so hard because, because in order to be successful, if you, in order to be up here, that means there has to be people below you, right? You know? So it's, there's this weird becoming the best at something, whether it's sports or this or that or the other thing, there has to be people that are still working to try to get towards you, and they maybe think that you are better than them, but you can't. It's so hard, it's hard for me to describe, but it's cognitive dissonance. It's another cognitive dissonance, because
it's
Yeah, and it's trying to do your best, but doing it in a way that people know that you just got there with hard work and humility. You know, so it's hard to be humble and show humility while also being the best, but it can be done, you know, and there's so many examples of it out there.
Is that one of your missions, is to show that, to expose your humility and hard work while being the best?
Yeah, because I think, you know, I mean, we see it all over the world. We see it in the movies. It's like, you know, the nice guy finishes last, right? Or, you know, or the bad guy doesn't care about anything, and he rubs so many people the wrong way, and he does so many of the wrong things, but he becomes the best because the good people were afraid to achieve that because they were good people.
Or but he didn't care. He just plowed through and
exactly,
went for it.
Exactly, you know, so it's so hard, and that's, but I think it, this generation, I think our generation was called to show that you can be a great person and show humility, but also be wildly successful and wildly, whatever it is for you to mean successful. It doesn't necessarily mean money, or doesn't necessarily mean fame, but it could mean money and it could be fame. You could, you know, it, there's absolutely nothing wrong with being wildly successful and making a ton of money and having a ton of people following you and have a huge following and sell books and do this and do that, whatever success is for you. There's nothing wrong with being extremely, extremely successful, because that, if you live the life, if you live a life that still shows humility.
Do you think God prepares people for success by putting them through trials and suffering and pain before? Do you think that's part of the process to become great? Do you think that's necessary? Or do you think you can avoid that?
I think it's absolutely necessary. It is hard to, I mean, as a Christian, it's hard to say that God would have you know, wanted, you know, because it's the age-old question, why does God, if God is such a loving and forgiving and amazing God, why does he let bad things happen to good people?
I know that, and like,
you
know, right now, Houston, the flood, like,
exactly,
why are these things, why does it happen?
And it's, and that, I think that's one of those questions that's so deep and so layered and so hard to answer. So along that same vein, I think what we describe, or what our definition of bad is, might be wrong sometimes, you know, so maybe God did let us go down a path that led to a dead end, or led to a loss, or led to
heartbreak,
a setback or heartbreak, and it was such a bad thing. But if that bad thing turns into something good, was that really a bad thing? You know, so that perception of what bad is, I mean, I've had a lot of bad things happen in my life, but I can look back and say, well, that wasn't so bad. And yeah, it was bad at the time, but shoot, if this happened because of that, I guess it wasn't really a bad thing. So it's our perception every single day, and it really is just believing believing in God's will. You know, I mean, the older I get, the less I pray for things.
Really?
And I pray that God's will be done, right?
You know, is that what you pray every day?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, because I think, like we said, you know, if something bad happens, that means maybe I was praying for something to happen, and then all of a sudden a bad thing happened, or maybe the bad thing was that not happening, or that not coming to fruition, but that might just be a closed door that's going to lead to another open door, right? You know, so it's,
yeah.
I don't know, the older you get,
the more you realize
that you're just trying to make it in this world. We're just flying by the seat of our pants. And I think that's something that if people live by that as well, that realizing that you might look at this person or that person and realize they have it all together, or think they have it all together, but they're just trying to make it in this world, or they're just flying by the seat of their pants too. And you're
yes.
just living on a whim and a prayer and just hoping that good things happen, you know. And that's, the older I get, the more I kind of have that, I guess, carefree kind of mentality. So
what has marriage taught you?
Oh my gosh. Oh man, it's been the most amazing thing ever.
You have an incredible wife. Y'all have an incredible, but I feel like y'all have done marriage right. You have the right perspective for marriage.
Yeah, I think it's been tough. I mean, not tough. It's with my career.
Right.
I mean, I long story short, I chased her for like 7 years, and I didn't really chase her. I had an idea of her for about 7 years when I was
in
college.
Did you know her?
Didn't really even know her. I knew her dad, and I knew his reputation.
You just loved
around
her right away?
Gosh, yeah. Well, yeah. It's
how
long
amazing.
Long story. Like,
what was it about her you loved?
Well, I just knew there was this idea of what I had of her. And then the day that we met, it could have been a huge letdown. You know, it could have been like, well, shoot, glad I wasted all that time thinking about this Bree Willett girl. but I went and I got this tooth knocked out in college wrestling. And then the University of Missouri sent me to her dad. He's a dentist.
My dad's a dentist, too.
Yeah, there you go. See? Yeah. So we're sitting there and I was looking at all these pictures and his family photos. And I'm like, dang, that little brunette is cute. I wonder if that's his daughter. And then I, you know.
But thank God you got your tooth knocked
exactly,
out.
Exactly. I will never, and it's still there. I've had 20 fights now, and this tooth is still sticking in there. Still got some good glue. But in a roundabout way, my Bible study leader was in a Bible study that he led, and then I was in another Bible study that all of her friends were in, and it was just, so I kept hearing these little stories about this girl, Bree Willett. I'm like, that's that girl. And then, of course, in our day and age, in our generation, it's so easy to hop on Facebook.com and then, you know, type in their name, and it's like, wow, okay, cute, really, really cute. Oh, wow, she likes this. Oh, wow, you know, so so I had this vision of, for some reason, I had this crush on her, and eventually I finally asked her to coffee, and here we are. We've been married 3 years now, but it's been a little over 4 years. But
what's the secret to marriage?
The secret to marriage is, I don't know, I think it's just constant service. You know, I think it's, for us, it's, I mean, if we're not kind of doing something for the other person, not out of necessity, but just out of love, or out of, just to constantly, that's how I show her how much I love her, is doing things for her, or reminding her how much I love her. Through, you know, there's the love languages and we practice those as much as possible. And I think it's just constant service, and it's constant humility. I mean, that's really what it is you never really have to be, I don't know, just that raw, like, here I am. This is me from head to toe. This is who I am, you know, and these are my insecurities, and these are my fears, and these are my goals, and these are my doubts, and these are my everything. And she's been with me when I was the world champion, right? You know, top three in the world, and then all the way down in the dumps, losing three fights in a row. And we've gone through this together, and it's made our marriage stronger. And we will be the parents that we are going to be because of the losses and the time away from each other. You know, she's been so awesome through my travel and my training camps and my wins and my losses. So I think that the secret to marriage is waking up every morning and realizing how truly blessed you are to have that person, and that constant service of the humility of, I'll do anything in the world for you, you know? So it's kind of what we do.
I love that. And y'all just moved to Nashville.
And we just moved to Nashville.
And
so
is it, you guys are going to be planting roots here? And
planting roots, yes. We got a house here.
So, yeah.
Yes, and I'm opening up a gym.
Okay, yeah, so we can all come to your gym. What's it called? Where is
it? It is not open yet. It's going to be Paramount Fitness, and it's right across the river in East Nashville.
That's where I live.
There
the
you
east
go.
Side.
The east side. Yeah.
Paramount Fitness.
Paramount Fitness, yeah. We're going to be on Davidson Street right
so
there.
So what can we expect in the gym?
So the gym is going to be, obviously, since I'm a fighter, my goal is to put Nashville on the map as a mixed martial arts city.
You know, awesome.
We got a couple MMA gyms here, but no real true blue pro fighters that live here. We had two guys that are in the UFC right now, Dustin Ortiz and Luke Sanders, who are from Nashville or from Franklin, that had to go to Arizona or California to go get their training because there's not a training hub here. So
you want to make this a training hub.
That's what I want to build. I mean, it's such a big city. It's not a huge city anymore, but it's a growing city.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a big enough city that we should have a phenomenal fight team.
You're right.
Now, you know, so
I have no doubt that you're going to make this happen.
There we go. So we'll have a pro fight team, but it'll be open to the general public. We're going to have a fitness group classes and one-on-one training, as well as adult and children's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, adult and children's MMA kickboxing classes and all that kind of stuff, plus a wrestling club. And so we're going to have a ton of programs and hopefully change a bunch of people's lives.
Heck.
Get them in shape.
Yes. Okay, so before we wrap up, my last question I like to ask all my guests. Mm-hmm. Well, one, I really want to know this from you. What is some advice you would tell your younger self?
I think just don't put so much pressure on yourself, and there's nothing wrong with being successful. There's absolutely nothing wrong with being successful.
I love that. This kind of goes hand in hand with my last question, which is leave your light. Which is leave some inspiration. How have you been inspired? What is it that you want your legacy to be and your inspiration to be? Or how have you been so inspired?
So I think it continues to go back to realizing and counting your blessings and realizing that you've been put in a position to be able to do something great. And every single day that you don't give your best is squandering those gifts that you've been given. And constantly remembering that it's not that people don't do the right things, it's that people don't do the right things for long enough. You know?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh.
that's good. That's been, you know,
because people give up when it gets hard.
You're just a constant work in progress. We all are. Gosh, I'm going to fail again, and I'm going to fail again. But through all that, I'm going to become a successful person. And if you can continue to move forward and continue to fight literally or figuratively for long enough, eventually you're going to continue to find success. So it's not that people don't do the right things. We can all do the right things for a day or a week or a month, but it's just that people don't do the right things for long enough. And so many of us have given up on a dream or given up on anything or any endeavor just moments before they were about to have that breakthrough, or moments before they were finally going to shake that one hand that got them to the next level. And you know, I think Nashville is a city of that, you know, and it's all about who you know and constantly grinding and trying to make it and scrape to the top, you know, and that's really what it is. It's not that people don't do the right things, it's that they don't do them for long enough.
Heck yes. Michael Chandler, mm-hmm. You know what your second half career is? Motivational speaking. I mean, seriously, like you,
it.
Tony Robbins, Joel Osteen, you were right
okay.
there with
that's,
them.
That's some big shoes to fill.
You have the feet to walk in them.
All right.
Michael Chandler, thank you for joining me on my show. Oh, you're amazing.
Thank you.
You're the best.
Thank you.
Peace. How inspiring was that episode? I mean, Michael Chandler has to be the most inspirational person on the planet. Him, Joel Osteen, and Tony Robbins. Them together are the most inspiring people. He is so uplifting. I feel like I just went to church or went to school or learned so much by just being around him and hearing what he had to say. I know you loved that episode. Get excited. Next week,
I have Jessie Alexander in the house. She is one of the most incredible songwriters in Nashville. She wrote The Climb for Miley Cyrus. She wrote I Drive Your Truck for Lee Bryce. She's written so many songs. Her story is so inspirational. I mean, there's a theme here. I like inspirational people. So get fired up. Jessie Alexander next week. See y'all soon.